Hi, this is Paul, and this is Rough Draft for Sunday, where I run through the current version of my Sunday sermon. A couple of notes about this. Someone commented in the comments last week or the week before, why don't I post my final sermons here on my personal YouTube channel? There are actually a few reasons for that. One is we are recording the service through a microphone on a camera, and I'm not mic'd very close, and so the audio quality on the church channel really isn't what it is on this channel. That's something that bit by bit Rick and I are working on, but we haven't really gotten there yet. Second, the video presentation on the church channel is getting better and better, but it's not really up to the standards of this channel either. Third, if you really want to hear what I've done with the sermon, you can go to the church channel and watch it. It is available to you. And it's a different channel. It's a different subscription. This is my own personal channel. It belongs to me. The church channel, in a sense, well, it's connected to my channel, but belongs to the church. And the content's a little bit different. And that's intentional on my part. I do these rough drafts as part of my process. And sometimes people ask me about my process. And so I preach on Sunday, obviously. I usually try not to do much sermon work on Monday to just give myself a day to refresh. Tuesday and Wednesday, depending on other things that I have going on in that week, I'll begin to sort of look at the passage and read through it a few times and probably do a little bit of exegetical work, look at the Greek or the Hebrew, dig into it, look at commentaries. Thursday, I sit down and write a first draft of the sermon. Usually, I might do a little bit of blogging, I might do a little bit of writing, and then create a PowerPoint. I usually like to have a PowerPoint almost completed by Thursday. And Friday mornings, we have the Bridges of Meaning Discord question and answer here. And then usually after the Q&A, Rick and I have tacos, or we fix something or prep something for the Sunday live stream. We've got that mostly dialed in at this point, depending on what happens with COVID. We're sort of waiting for Canon is going to release a PTZ camera. And we're not terribly happy with our PTC optics, the quality of that lens and of that camera, so We'll see what happens with Canon and if the church has the money and the budget for a new camera, so to have better video on Sundays. And then Friday afternoon, I will, after Rick goes, I'll usually read through the chat that goes on during my during my question and answer, because I can't look at that while I'm doing the question and answer. I'll be totally distracted. And then maybe check in if some people are still hanging out in the Discord server and chat with them. And then I get down to work on the sermon. And then maybe if I have time, late Friday afternoon, I'll do a video, something that I can release for Monday. So that's sometimes people have questions about my schedule, and that's my schedule. Now, in terms of the rough drafts, some are rougher than others, and I think this one's kind of rough. Last week's was pretty much there, but as is true of a lot of the monologue videos, I learn a lot talking through the sermon out loud, and I don't know if it's entirely, my whole channel are first drafts and impromptu conversations, so why should you expect anything different? And I actually try to read the comments from the first draft before I preach it on Sunday. Now, there's an irony to there. Ooh, how many times more people will see the rough draft than will see the sermon? But again, as I'll be releasing a conversation I had with Sevilla King, who uses her YouTube channel kind of the way I use mine, except she's been walking through Persig, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, and Lila. And I use this channel to talk out loud and to listen from you. And so I actually spend a fair amount of time during the week going through and reading comments from you. And some of you leave long, thoughtful comments. And I don't just read positive comments. I also read the negative comments. So you are very much a part of my sermon prep. And YouTube commenters, this is one of the surprises of my YouTube channel, that I found YouTube comments being remarkably helpful. you guys write good comments. And I was expecting it to kind of be a waste of space like you see on bigger comments. But no, the comments have been, again, even if I check something like Peugeot's channel, the comment section on my channel is often a lot better. I'm not trying to make a, 'cause I know there's a lot of overlap between the community, but it's just sort of part of the culture of the channel. So that's part of the reason I do these Discord, these rough drafts for Sunday, because my Sunday sermon is shaped by your feedback. Now, in many ways, my Sunday sermon is given for the saints at Living Stones and for those who watch, and that's a far, you know, on a Sunday, I don't know, between 1 and 200 people will see the final draft at least within a day or two of me giving it. So it's a much smaller audience than those that see the rough draft. But I appreciate your comments. I'm those of you who follow my channel quite carefully, I'm not often online much on Saturday and Sunday. Saturday is my Sabbath in many ways, and I tried to keep that Sabbath by not doing much of any work. And during COVID, my wife and I have sort of established a really nice routine of travel on Saturday. We take day trips. We have scoured Northern California and its beauty and its culture, and have really enjoyed our Saturdays together. And sometimes kids come and sometimes they don't. Sundays, of course, are busy with the church, and that's the life of a pastor. So yeah, a little longer preamble to the rough draft, but a little bit more context for some of you who've wondered about it. So my first question in the sermon is, where did Jesus go after the resurrection when he wasn't with his disciples? And on the screen, for those of you who are watching and not listening, you know, another thing that's been interesting is that the audio-only podcast is about half the size of the YouTube audience, which doesn't surprise me because many of the people who listen to the audio-only version, you know, also are YouTube subscribers. But that listenership has continued to rise pretty steadily, and I think it's mostly an auditory-focused channel that I have in many ways. But I do have PowerPoints and charts and some of those things. So, okay, back to that, distracting myself. I don't do that on Sunday morning. It's a little bit easier to stay focused in front of the people. Where did Jesus go after the resurrection when he wasn't with his disciples? Did you ever ask that question? I've never researched that question theologically, and this is the kind of thing that the comment section usually helps me out, because you all are smarter than just me myself, and so you have access to information I don't have, and so I learn and grow from you, from your comments. But so what I have on the plate on the slide here is a chart of all of Jesus' post-resurrection appearances and the book of the Bible that they're in. And, you know, there's a lot of them on Resurrection Sunday. There's, of course, the 11 on the following Sunday with the confrontation with doubting Thomas. Sometime later, there's, you know, the 7 fishing at the Sea of Galilee. There's 11 disciples on the mountain, and then there's more than 500, and you have that in 1 Corinthians 5, 6. This is kind of a nice chart that I found on the internet. Jesus, James, that was 1 Corinthians 15, 7, and then the disciples at the Ascension. But Jesus, as we've noted in previous post-Easter sermons, Jesus just keeps popping in and out. Now, did you ever pause and ask yourself, where is he when he's not popping in and out? That's actually a very interesting question, and I haven't thought about it a lot, but I thought about it to provoke what is probably an answer that many of you will say, well, when he's not with the disciples, he's with his Father in heaven. Okay. But then, why the ascension? And actually, this is actually going to have a lot more content than my Sunday sermon will on this account. I wrote a Substack, and you know, I've been working Substack now because this YouTube is, many of you who are on YouTube have the kinds of jobs where you have a lot of auditory content and some of you video content. And so you can listen to long-form podcasts and long content. many, many people can't, and they're much more attuned to written material. And so one of the things that I've wanted to try to do is in some ways expand the reach of my channel much more into the written sphere. That's a whole other thing. And so I'm sort of using Twitter and Substack together to see where that goes. And so I've been playing with that. And in a lot of ways, now all this that I'm saying now, I might radically change my sermon, and this might be the beginning of my sermon, except the people in church are a lot less interested in my YouTube life than all of you are. And that impacts the sermons as well. But I don't know if I would have this whole YouTube thing going or the Jordan Peterson stuff if a number of years ago, a member of my church, you know, I'd been preaching through the Bible, yada, yada, and, you know, always kind of in and out of liturgical seasons. And there was one year that I, you know, in the Christian Reformed Church order, generally speaking, Ascension Day is a Thursday, because it's always a Thursday, is a Thursday evening service. And we haven't, the years I've been here at Living Stones, we've never had a Thursday evening Ascension Day service. And then one Sunday, Ascension Sunday, which is the Sunday after, which is a little bit of a cheat, I didn't preach on the Ascension. And one of my members, an older member, who's very much dyed-in-the-wool CRC, said, "You didn't preach on the Ascension." And I thought, eh. And then I thought, why didn't I preach on the Ascension? Well, is it because I didn't think the Ascension was very important? Not like Easter, not like Christmas, not like Good Friday. It's just this weird thing that's added on. Never thought much about the Ascension. Never, you know, again, I grew up with these stories. I never doubted the physicality of the Ascension. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought, this whole thing is weird. And actually, Eric Dirksen, my colleague over in Davis, made a comment at the beginning of the week because he's working on his Ascension stuff. And over there, Christchurch Davis, I don't know if they have an Ascension Day service. They might. They do things like that over in Davis. Eric will have a church service even if there's, you know, just a tiny little group of people there at all. That's, you know, he's that way. But what does the Ascension mean? And that in the backdrop of a lot of thinking about the conflict between this contemporary worldview that we have versus a classical worldview or even a medieval worldview got me thinking a lot about Jesus' ascension. And actually C.S. Lewis, and of course you know, one of my favorite books from him, Miracles, deals with the ascension quite a bit. Why? And if you answer this question, well, where is Jesus between popping in on the disciples? I mean, he's spending some time with them, but he seems to sort of come and go. Well, he's with his Father. Okay. But if he can just pop in and out of heaven between stops, talking on the road of Emmaus or having, you know, confronting Thomas or finding them fishing on the lake, yada, yada, yada. Why ascend? Now, because I use visuals a lot, sometimes I'll just pick usually something from the Renaissance period, and here's a Renaissance painting of Christ's ascension. Now, this is not what people think about today when they think about us. They don't think about all of these angels. Well, why? Well, what's happening in this picture? What is the deal with the ascension? It doesn't make sense to modern people. Why? Because we regularly go up into the air and we come down again, but some go up into the space station and, well, we're on a sphere turning around a flaming ball of gas. And then if you look at cosmologies, you begin to notice that, hey, wait a minute. Well, the ascension sort of makes sense. So on the left here, I have pictured basically a cosmology from from Dante's Divine Comedy, and you'll see the Aristotelian medieval classical mashup that C.S. Lewis writes about in his book The Discarded Image. And you have the music of the spheres. Well, what are the spheres? Well, the spheres are all these different layers, and there's air down below, but only when you get to the moon. And then, well, Earth is the center, and people always say, you know, a geocentric universe, but Earth is also the lowest level in that, and lowest is not a good thing, all right? And, of course, Dante sort of has some other interesting things going on in terms of if you see Jerusalem way down at the bottom and then into hell, and then you go down to the lowest, lowest reaches of hell that are, you know, in the earth, and then you kind of come up to purgatory, and you go all the way up to the top of purgatory, and you have on the top of that the earthly paradise, because medievals often would put the Garden of Eden on their maps. And then up from there, now you have the ascension all the way up, 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 up through the spheres. You know, the moon, Mercury, Venus, Sun, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn. And then you've got the stars. And then finally up above there, you'll have paradise. And so ascension, well, but then if you look on the other side of the map, we have sort of this ancient Hebrew conception of the universe where you've got sort of a flat earth and you've got foundations of the earth and Sheol is in the under earth and above you have the firmament, we have the sun, the sky, the moon, the clouds, the stars, and above the firmament you have the gates of heaven and it goes up, 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 up to heaven. Now, I'm gonna tinker with this a little bit later, but again, there, the ascension makes perfect sense. Jesus goes up, and Jesus goes up to heaven. That's how you go. But again, if Jesus was sort of popping in and out, Jesus didn't need to have this dramatic ascension and be lost. And all of that is for a message, just like all of other Jesus' miracles, is to message his disciples about the relational state of the universe. But now here we are watching pictures from Mars. And when we think of the just the solar system, we have this huge sun and then tiny little Mercury, Venus, Earth, you know, third rock from the sun, tiny little blue marble. And then Mars, where we're sending, you know, little robots now to look around and send pictures back. And then the gas giants, Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus and Neptune. What sense does it make that Jesus ascends? It's just weird. Now, if you go to the Heidelberg Catechism, which is basically late medieval, early modern, how does Christ's ascension benefit to heaven benefit us? First, he pleads our cause in heaven. But right away, for us, heaven is sort of a, well, where is heaven? And very quickly, people are sort of like, well, that's the wrong kind of question. First, he pleads our cause in heaven, in the presence of the Father. Second, we have our own flesh in heaven, very locale. You know, so again, where does Jesus between stops down below here? You know, LDS Church will have him hop over and visit the Americas and, you know, kind of, well, how are you getting around? You're kind of spirited away, just like the Deacon Philip. Second, we have our own flesh in heaven, a guarantee that Christ our head will take us, his members, to himself in heaven. Well, we sort of have an idea about that. And then third, he sends his Holy Spirit to us on earth as a further guarantee. By the Spirit's power, we make the goals of our lives not earthly things, but the things above where Christ is sitting at the right hand of God. Now, this leads to all sorts of ideas about, well, when people die, they go to heaven and they stay there forever, which, well, no, we're Christians, and so we believe in resurrection. We're not Gnostics. So this is strange. And the lectionary has us in Luke for the ascension, which is a little different from Acts. Well, it's not different, but it's in continuation. Acts begins with the ascension, which actually makes perfect sense. Luke ends with the ascension. While they were still talking about this, Jesus himself, this is one of the resurrection appearances, Jesus himself stood among them and said to them, "Peace be with you." And they were startled, thinking they saw a ghost. Then he said to them, "Why are you troubled? Why do your doubts rise in your minds? Look at my hands and feet. It is I myself. Touch me and see. A ghost does not have flesh and bones, as you see I have." When he said this, he showed them his hands and feet. And while they still did not believe it, because of joy and amazement, he asked them, "Do you have anything to eat?" And they gave him a piece of broiled fish, and he took it and ate it in their presence. I mean, the whole point of this is that he has a body, he has flesh, he has renewed flesh. He said to them, "This is what I told you while I was still with you. Everything must be fulfilled that is written about me in the law of Moses, prophets, and the Psalms." Then he opened their minds so they could understand the scriptures. And he told them, "This is what is written. The Messiah will suffer and rise from the dead on the third day. And repentance for the forgiveness of sins will be preached in his name to all nations, beginning at Jerusalem." And you'll notice in these medieval maps, you know, these conceptualizations are not necessarily physical, geographical, but they have to do with the meaning of the story. "You are witnesses of these things. I am sending you what my Father has promised. But stay in the city until you have been clothed with power from on high." And we had actually read this before. Then he led them out to the vicinity of Bethany. And he lifted up his hands and blessed them. That's what you do if you're a Jew. That's the tradition. And while he was blessing them, he left them and was taken up into heaven. Not a lot of detail. But again, notice, heaven is up there. Ask a child, where's heaven? Where's the bad place? We all sort of know this. This is our orientation. And again, those of you watching online know that, you know, Jonathan Peugeot has all of these things. And well, you know, the head is on top of the body of head and feet. And actually, this symbolism, this whole symbolic system works. But now we're going to pay attention to the disciples. Then they worshipped him and returned to Jerusalem with great joy. And they stayed continually at the temple praising God. And I think for the Ascension Day, when I read this time, it was like, now wait a minute, let's slow this thing down and look at it. So one of the things that you do if you're a pastor like me and you're working on your sermon is you open up the Greek and say, let's look at the verbs in that sentence. They worshipped him. Now, right away, when you hear that, that's an interesting word, because the word is basically means physically, like most words start with sort of a physical referent, and then we build on them from there. And so this bowing down is, well, something that, let's say, if there was a great king before you or your lord in terms of the lord of the manor or the lord of the land, you might bow down before someone who was your superior to ask for clemency or a favor or something like that. So it is not something that Jews would never do, but it is something special, because the word also sort of has a double meaning of something much more of what we look at in terms of worship. And I wondered about that sentence, because in English, then they worshipped him. See, I changed. I doctored it, actually. Because in English, the NIV says, basically, they worshipped him and returned to Jerusalem. And that's a very valid translation of that. But the main verb is that they returned. And the and the worship, it's worshiping. It's a participle. So when are they falling down on their faces? Or is this much more that they're worshiping Jesus, which, wait a minute, already very much after the resurrection, their posture towards Jesus begins to change. And when I say posture, look at how that word fit there. Their stance, look at how that word fit there. They're worshiping him. Right away, this is a little disquieting in terms of the strict focus among the Jews of, you shall have no other gods before me. Don't you shall not bow down to them or worship them. And they seem to be now bowing down to Jesus. And did they do that after he left? Or is, in fact, they're not actually physically down, bowing down, but this is a statement about what, in fact, they are doing after he goes. Now, I know this because at the end of the Gospel of Matthew, you have the same thing. So the 11 disciples proceeded to Galilee to the mountain which Jesus had designated for them, and when they saw him, they bowed down to him. But some doubted. And when you read this text, anyone reading this text should say, now, wait a minute. What are they doing? We don't find them just doing this thing before. But he seems to be popping in and out. And when he comes back, this is what they do to him. And this is a little sketchy for people who have been formed to be very, very circumspect about who they worship and what they worship. And then where do they go? And they stayed continually at the temple, praising God. So you get the sense of praise and worship, and return to Jerusalem, but why do they go to the temple? Well, what is the temple? And how does the temple function in their cosmology? Cosmology is basically the logos of the cosmos, their worldview, their word picture. Well, the temple down below is in many ways a replica of the temple up above. And even though we don't think geographically, physically that way, the temple is in some ways the closest place to where Jesus is. Because the assumption is that he goes up through the clouds, they're right there, and up into what the temple up in the sky, where there'll be a throne, and he sits at the right hand of God the Father, Apostles' Creed. And so in order to be close to Jesus, you stay at the temple down below. But remember, Jesus cursed the fruit tree, the fig tree, and, you know, threw over the money changers' tables in the temple and talked about the temple being destroyed. And there's a lot going on in this, and it's all sort of woven into the text. And unless you pause and ask yourself some seemingly simple questions about the text, you might not begin to see what all is going on in the text. Now, we're sort of stuck in Sun, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter. And so the Heidelberg Catechism is sort of a transition point. And notice that all of the elements of the catechism are relational. And I think that's key in terms of how to deal with the discordant worldviews that are sort of stacking up here. Because we're not quite sure how to handle them. And I mentioned that C.S. Lewis was a big help to me in this, in his book Miracles. Here's just one of the, I put a number of quotes on my blog from this book about the Ascension, because that actually impacted me quite a bit. The real and pernicious period of literalism comes far later, in the Middle Ages and the 17th century, when the distinctions have been made and heavy-handed people tried to force the separate conceptions together in wrong ways. The fact that Galilean shepherds could not distinguish that what they saw at the Ascension from the kinds of ascent which, by its very nature, could never be seen at all, people don't fly, does not prove on one hand that they were unspiritual, nor on the other that they saw nothing, because that's sort of the way it goes. Well, this was symbolic writing by the apostles. No, they didn't write it down right away. This is symbolic memory. No, this idea comes from events. But why would Jesus ascend into the clouds? Well, the same reason he turned water into wine, and the same reason he multiplied loaves and fishes, and especially turning water into wine, well, and he walked on water. Why? These were statements. His miracles were almost always statements designed to enact belief and to provoke new thinking about his identity in the world that would inform the church perpetually. That's the point of these miracles. And ascension is a very important one, not because Jesus can fly the way he can shine on Transfiguration Sunday, but because how it says the world works and how that impacts our relationship with him. A man who really believes that heaven is in the sky may well in his heart have a far truer and more spiritual conception of it than many a modern logician who could expose that fallacy with a few strokes of his pen. For he who does the will of the Father shall know the doctrine. Irrelevant material splendors in such a man's idea of the vision of God did him no harm and will do him no harm. For they are not there for their own sakes, meaning the images. Purity from such images is a merely theoretical Christian's idea, will do no good if they have been banished only by logical criticism. And so again, we see, well, what is this ascension about? He pleads our cause. We have a relationship with him, and he goes to the Father. He is the mediator between us and the high God who is up on the throne, because he's at the right hand, right? All the symbolism works together. Our flesh, we are elevated by the ascension as a guarantee that Christ, our head, will take us, his members, to himself in heaven. But now I would tinker with this catechism because it's his resurrected flesh. Well, what does that mean? It means it's our flesh, but now perfected. And we are on that journey too. And the catechism is pointing to that. Third, he sent his son to us on earth as a further guarantee. By the Spirit's power, we make the goal of our lives not earthly things, but the things above us where Christ is sitting at the right hand. Now, again, the problem that I see of the language and how this language is heard now, you know, some 500 years later after it was written, is that our categories have moved, and this sort of makes a lot of Christians Gnostic, but it shouldn't. N.T. Wright also, on speaking about ascension, says this: the early Christians, like their Jewish contemporaries, saw heaven and earth as the overlapping and interlocking spheres of God's good creation. Hence all the angels all the way up. Okay, Jacob's ladder, remember that? With the point that being that heaven is the control room from which the earth is run. And this was just simply common belief, hence the looking at the stars and belief in astrology, that that's the control room, and as they move things in the control room, things on earth will be moved below. Jesus' prayer in the Sermon on the Mount, "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, from heaven down to earth, on earth as it is in heaven." That's the relationship. And again, it's really helpful to understand the symbolism and, in a sense, the symbolic geography, but mostly we're dealing relationally. That tends to be the way that we're managing it. To say that Jesus is now in heaven is to say three things. First, that he is present with his people everywhere. That's really important. No longer confined to one space-time location within earth, but certainly not absent. Second, that he is now the managing director of the strange show called Earth, though like many other chief executives, he has quite a lot to do to sort out and to turn it around. Third, that he will one day bring heaven and earth together as one, becoming therefore personally present to us once more within God's new creation. The Bible doesn't say much about our going to heaven. It says a lot about heaven, and particular heaven's chiefs, chief inhabitants, coming back to earth. In other words, Jesus is in heaven, as the Heidelberg Catechism says. Our flesh is in heaven. It's sort of like we're going up to the control room. One of us is there because he came down And that is intended to give us great comfort when things on earth don't seem to make sense. And that's where I engage this, well, we make the goal of our lives not earthly things. But wait a minute, I thought the focus of the relationship was that heaven will come down to earth. And so now here in the Heidelberg Catechism, it's talking about the focus, and that's exactly right. It should be the focus, but it's not just escapism from the body or escapism from below. It's thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven, because this is where we're at. Is there a way to bridge the gap? What does this ascension mean? It is, in fact, his governing of this world from above, and our walking by his Spirit, which he sends from heaven, down to the world through us here below. Now notice the last two, the elements of the last lines of the Gospel of Luke. Worship. Well, what is worship? Worship is attention. And those of you, I probably won't say this on Sunday, those of you watching the Peugeot video and now the Gilchrist video are paying attention to worship, because in many ways what we focus on is what we're attracted to. Our eyes are in the front of the body, and where we see, we tend to follow. All of those things that they had been told, that is actually what's built into the Gospels from the start. I used to read these and think, they spent all that time, the Gospel writers, all that time talking about all this previous stuff, and here at the end, Jesus seems to come to the conclusion, and the Gospel writers don't include it. No, these Gospels were written a little bit later than the events, and so actually, they're seeing the Old Testament through Jesus, and that's exactly what the Gospel writers do, as well as the epistles and the New Testament. Our attention is directed to him. Our obedience to him. He is the model. We are acting it out. He is moving us from heaven through his Spirit out into the world. And the second is temple. Now, of course, they were in the temple daily praising God, and so the worship and the praise was all happening from the temple. But in 70 AD, the temple is destroyed. And even before that happens, it's quite clear that the church, where two or three are gathered, the church does not have a place at its center. Its center is, just like N.T. Wright said, available everywhere. So when the church meets here, we are his temple. Why? Because two or three gather, you're the temple of the Holy Spirit, living stones. All of these New Testament themes says the temple is here. And so as we're gathering here, well, we're awaiting the gifts of the Spirit. We're awaiting the return of the King. We're embodying the new creation in the midst of the age of decay, but our tiny little temples are in relationship to the grand temple, and that kingdom will come, and his will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And that day is coming, and in the meantime, our focus is above. Now pay attention. This language is natural to us. Even if we stop and think, wait a minute, I thought above is like atmosphere, and then the death of space, and then the moon, and on and on and on. Yes, but it's the relational connection. And we're embodying the new creation in the midst of the age of decay. And, well, now we're heading towards Pentecost, where that Spirit will come. And instead of one central temple and one central place, there will be lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of temples. Not buildings, although sometimes we call them things, but the people, the saints, assembled, gathered, praising, worshiping, looking to him, obeying him, living him out in the world, the multiplication of him, all over the world, going up, coming down through his Spirit, out into the world, his kingdom come, His will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Ascension Day is a very big deal, and I have to repent of my ignorance beforehand. And I hope, as a result of this sermon, ignorance may in fact be pushed back.